Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
G'day everyone, and welcome back to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. So great to have you listening today. You're actually listening to episode 101, which is actually the second part of episode 100, which is our special 100th episode roundup of some of the exciting, innovative discussions that we've been having here on the podcast since I started back a year and a half or 2 years ago. And a special welcome to my Inner Circle Piano Teaching community members wherever you are around the world. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is proudly sponsored by my Inner Circle community, your one-stop online shop for piano teaching inspiration, training, lesson plans, business advice, and support. The Inner Circle is the place to get your piano teaching questions answered and to hang out with other teachers and music education experts from around the world. From Norway to New Zealand and Indiana to Idaho, we'll help you build the studio of your dreams. You can get access straight away to some of my top-rated video courses, including PianoFlix, How to Teach Pop Piano, my Notebook Beginners course, Piano Studio Marketing, and Teaching the 12-Bar Blues and Jazz Improv. And we've also got a number of courses currently in production: group teaching, how to convert to group teaching, four chord composing, and grooving with GarageBand. And we've got a lot more planned as well. The Inner Circle is a thriving community of dedicated, passionate teachers who are committed to giving their students the very best opportunities possible and sharing all their wins with the community. Find out how you can become a part of the Inner Circle at timtopham.com/community. And of course, you can take $100 off an annual membership locked in for as long as you're a member right now with the code PIANOPODCAST. So if you've been listening to episode 100, I'm sure I won't need to do too much introduction for this episode. It's a straight continuation on from where we left off last week. So in episode 100, we introduced the concept of our 100th episode roundup, where we were looking at three areas of teaching, and I was picking the best responses and discussions I've had with teachers over the last 2 years on these three topics. The first one was all about creative teaching, getting started and the mindset around it, how the view of teaching is really changing as we progress in these times at the moment, and some great simple ideas that you can do in your studio with your students. Always great to share these discussions with teachers. So if that's a topic that's of interest and you'd like to find out the best ideas that we've had over the last 100 episodes, then make sure you tune in to episode 100. You can find that by heading to timtopham.com/episode100. Today, we're continuing the roundup looking at business, and we're going to be talking about topics including how to have a life and run a business, how to hire teachers if you want to build more of an academy, how you can make a living running a traveling teaching studio, and also some great ideas about how to nurture new student leads coming into your studio. And then we'll also have a look at some of the best teaching transformation ideas that I've been able to discuss with people over the last couple of years, including ideas around special needs teaching, motivating students, the neuroscience behind it, rote teaching, and technique. I can't wait to share this with you. Here we go. One of the topics that has garnered most interest in the blog and podcast in the last couple of years has been business, and particularly those kind of topics related to growing your studio, marketing, getting more students, automating systems, technology, all those kinds of things. We've featured blogs, podcasts, courses, and webinars on this topic, and it's really, really been helpful for teachers as they build and grow. And one of the things that I have been asked about a lot is when the right time is to find another teacher to help you with your teaching, because you've got a waiting list that goes out to 2 or 3 years or whatever. How do you go about finding new teachers or finding a teacher that could help you? Should you move into a commercial space? Can you add teachers in your own studio? Should you travel to their houses? All these kinds of questions. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, we're all business owners if we're an independent studio teacher, but very, very few of us have ever had any kind of business training. And so that's why I've been really happy to invite lots of guests on and have guest authors write posts on the blog to help teachers with some of these topics, because I also don't have all the answers necessarily, and there's people that have done many, many amazing things in their teaching, and that's why I've wanted to have these kinds of discussions with them. My first ever podcast about business was with my great friend Carly McDonald from Nova Music in Adelaide in Australia here. Carly owns a big multi-teacher and multi-instrument studio and came on the show to talk about what to do when your student gets too big. When to hire other teachers to help you out, and how to actually go about doing that. It gets a lot of discussion in our Inner Circle forums about teachers who realize that they're in demand but just can't keep up with it. So what should they do next? And while, of course, hiring other teachers and building a multi-teacher studio isn't for everyone, if this is something that you've been considering, then I hope you'll find this really, really helpful. So in this first clip, I asked Carly why she hired her first teacher, how many students were on her wait list at the time, and how she suggests others can grow their studios organically.
What was it that made you decide, I'm going to hire another teacher rather than just start a waiting list?
Because my time's finite. Okay. I can only be one-on-one teaching a certain amount of hours a week. And I thought, well, I've got all this interest, and what can I do that can make sure that the people can have lessons and I can earn money and yep. they can all be taught? So I wanted to set it up so that my family life could still be what I wanted it to be, and that I could still run a business and develop a business that didn't require my time to be used.
Yeah, sure. Yep. And I imagine, in fact, as the place has grown, although your work, you do a lot of work, you can decide how much of that you do and when you do it and things like that too. So it's more
absolutely
flexible. Yeah.
Yeah, very flexible. I also now have someone who works with me on Wednesdays, and she does a lot of the admin for me for the business. And that's really helped free me up, I suppose, to do what I would prefer to be doing in the business.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you, how many students did you have kind of waiting or needing a new teacher when you decided to hire someone else? Or did you just, four, okay.
Four.
And so you hired that person and with the aim of them teaching just four students initially?
No, just with the aim of I didn't have any more room or time. Mm-hmm. And if we started, it would get the ball rolling, and she just wanted a little bit of work to start with, and then we filled out her night of teaching, and then I started getting inquiries for guitar, and so I went, oh, well, why not? Let's give it a go. And so I found a guitar teacher who wanted to come in, and so it kept happening.
Yeah. So it's grown very organically, more inquiries have come in.
Yes.
You grow.
I at times I've made big pushes for certain things. When we're starting at a new location or things like that, there's had to be quite significant work. But from the business background perspective, I think the best way for a business to grow is organically. You need to be able to set up the policies and procedures and all the background mechanics so that the business can function. If a business just explodes, you're not going to get really good functionality down the track. You're just going to end up with constant scrabbling trying to make things work. So if you do things consistently and over time, then you're going to end up getting something that's going to work long term.
And putting those systems in place to help it grow.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you don't have the systems, then parents get angry and teachers are not happy and schools are angry.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And your world is very difficult.
In the rest of that episode, we get into the nitty-gritty of developing systems and hiring staff and all those kinds of things that you need to think about, which Carly has gone through herself, starting as an independent private single teacher to owning multiple locations with multiple students and multiple instruments. It's a fantastic story. And if you're interested in this, and particularly in the kinds of questions that Carly asks teachers during interviews, then make sure you check out the show notes for episode number 7. 60 episodes later, in episode 67, I interviewed another studio owner and entrepreneur, Abraham Levitan of pianopower.org, which is a music studio in Chicago. And we talk about how he went from teaching on his own in students' houses to running a business teaching over 400 students with a team of traveling teachers. Yes, you heard that correctly. He's actually built a traveling music academy with his teachers all visiting students' houses. Have a listen to the start of this fascinating story.
And so when I started teaching piano lessons on my own in 2000, quite frankly, I was going by the seat of my pants and thinking, what do I love about music and how do I translate that into enthusiasm for my students? Now, I mean, suffice to say, I had had piano lessons myself, classical and jazz, all throughout elementary school, middle school, and high school. So I did have that background to fall back on. But as far as coming in with a method, my method was to keep my students engaged and to do that by any means necessary. So it was very pro pop music, very pro original composition, you know, busting out little arrangements of Kelly Clarkson songs in 5 minutes and having them work on them during the week. So
very, very similar approach to how I came through as well, because I didn't have that that long conservatory training or anything like that. Although I had a music degree, it wasn't in piano specifically. So I was kind of the same. I'm like, okay, how do I keep these kids engaged? Let's do what works.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, conservatory training, we can go into hiring later because I know that was a topic you wanted to discuss. But conservatory training to me can be a double-edged sword when it comes to evaluating potential teachers, because sometimes the realities of working with a seven-year-old who's squirming around on the piano bench and kind of wants to be there and kind of doesn't requires a very different skill set from what works in an academy or university setting. And I sometimes think that teachers who go into it with nothing but the sense of, well, I really love music and I want to communicate that enthusiasm, are often a little bit more flexible in those kind of situations. So anyway, back to how Piano Power sort of evolved from that. 2001, I started teaching myself. I never had, you know, I hear of teachers that have 100 students every week. I never got to that level, but I had maybe 40.
That's probably why you're still teaching.
And around 2007, after I had been doing it for 6 years, you know, I developed a waiting list. I'm certainly not unique in that category, but it kind of happens once you have your own practice and new families start calling and you start saying things like, well, I think in 2 or 3 years, I might have a spot available. And a parent of a 6-year-old that really wants to start lessons does not want to hear that at all.
Yeah.
So at that point, you know, I started thinking, well, maybe there is room to have other instructors that are like-minded who can help me process this waiting list, essentially. So there was no plan. I mean, I'm a very type A person and I love planning. So like when I started having a business, I went out and got Small Business for Dummies and, you know, personal MBA for dummies and all this stuff and just tried to act like I knew what I was doing. But really, it was a very seat of the pants operation for the first few years. And we will now have our 10th anniversary this coming spring. And we're at about 425 students, which is at least four times what I ever dreamed of having.
If you'd like to hear about more of this story, and particularly if you are a traveling teacher yourself, then make sure you check out episode 67. If you're interested to know particularly about how Abraham separates the good teachers from the bad teachers when he's interviewing, then definitely check out the episode because he shares one of his best tricks for finding teachers who he knows will teach in the same way as him and have the ability to teach creatively using chords and composing pop and improv. One of the hardest things, I think, for any teacher contemplating hiring another teacher to help is making sure somehow that they're going to teach using your philosophies and in the way that you believe is appropriate. How to do that becomes really, really difficult. And if the only thing you're doing at an interview is chatting to someone, then my hint is you're never going to find out. In this episode, he also talks about how he builds culture and supports teachers who he only sees every so often because, of course, they're all working in different buildings and parents, students' houses. Fascinating story. Make sure you check that one out. For the last clip on business, we're going back only a few episodes to episode 93, when I interviewed Chantel Duffield from Studio Expansion on the topic of how to nurture and retain students on autopilot. Now, what's autopilot in the case of a studio business, you might be wondering? Well, have a listen as Chantel discusses the business-changing nature of an automated email nurture sequence and why sending new student inquiries lots of new information might not be the best way to start a new relationship.
In the early days, one of the first things that we encourage you to put in terms of technology into the business is an automated lead follow-up system. A nurture sequence is what I like to teach.
Okay, you better tell us what that means quickly.
I will, because this will change your life. So imagine at the moment, like the most of you guys would probably have experienced that you might get an email inquiry. Hi, my little Tina is interested in starting piano lessons. She's 8. She's never done lessons before, da-da-da-da-da. And you get this through the contact us section of the website. And then what happens then is usually in a perfect world, you'll finish teaching at 9 o'clock at night and you're shattered and you might pour yourself a little glass of wine and you'll write back to Tina's mum and say, sure, why don't you come for a class, da 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 da. But what can also happen is that, oh, you had something happen and you're a bit tired, you get to it the next day sometimes and you write back, but you don't hear back from Tina's mum. And so, you know, we've got this hole in the bucket, if you like. And so one of the biggest challenges that we see from studio owners is then you've kind of written back, but then again, there's no follow-up. So we've got no way of kind of just dripping and just kind of tapping them on the shoulder until they come back. So one of my favorite things that just changes businesses entirely and just makes your life a lot easier is we put into place this automated nurture sequence. And what this is a series of emails that's connected to the back end of your website. So imagine Tina's mum writes, hi, Tim, I want to kind of send Tina for music lessons. Automatically, straight away, there is this beautiful, beautiful email that gets sent to them straight away saying, hi, Mergefield inquirer's name. Yeah?
Yep.
And it says, thank you so much for reaching out. It's a pleasure to be able to hear from you. We can't wait to find out more about Mergefield Tina and what they are looking for in their classes. We're going to be getting back to you as soon as possible. In the meantime, we would love for you to let us know a little bit more about Tina. Has she done lessons before? What type of music does she like? Da 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 da. Now, the intention here is very, very specific. Most people think that when they respond to an email inquiry for a potential student, they want to share information. Sure, our classes are this amount. Here is the location. This is what you need to bring. It's like they respond and we hit them with an information in the face, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I want to flip that because I know that from a conversion perspective, if we can engage that inquiry in connecting with why they're looking for and helping them to feel cared for, helping them to feel like you're interested in their child. I mean, that's everything. So even while you're still teaching, Tina's mum has sent the inquiry and straight away there's this email saying, tell me a little about Tina. What do parents like to talk about most?
Their children.
Kids, yeah? Yeah, kids. So this is starting as opposed to just kind of emailing them information. We're entering into a dialogue with that parent and we're showing them straight away. Then when you do go to respond, because you will, but we're buying you some time. This is your backup plan, yeah?
Well, ultimately, so you actually haven't done anything yet.
We have not touched.
You might be asleep when this is all going on.
This is the dream.
Yeah.
This is the dream. So then Tina's mum writes back saying, oh, you know, she just loves jazz. She loves jazz, da-da-da-da-da, tells her about it. She's a bit shy, da-da-da-da-da, never done lessons before, da-da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, so that does give you some more information. Then let's say day 3. So they've sent the email inquiry on day 0 and then we've sent this lovely connection back. Then there's like a whole sequence we follow, but then we might send an email saying, here are the top 3 FAQs that a parent asks when they're wanting to send their child to piano. And then we answer them. We kind of, what are their biggest fears? What are the things you get asked the most? And again, we might direct them from that email back to your website to a beautiful, like maybe it's you, Tim. Maybe it's like, hi, my name's Tim, and I just want to welcome you to Tim's studio. We're so passionate about helping each of our students to be able to perform with confidence and to really fall in love with music, da 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 da. And so then they get to connect with you again. You know, I see that the biggest opportunity that so many music educators leave on the table is that they're trying to sell their lessons and what they do,
as opposed to trying to connect with what the people are looking for and helping them to build that relationship early on. And that is the joy of marketing. That's the joy of marketing. So through this beautiful sequence of emails that we kind of, it's just little taps on the shoulder, little taps on the shoulder, because Tina's mum may have got, you know, something, had a bad day at work and she forgot to get back to you. Having this sequence in place, this nurture sequence, it is your follow-up plan that's got your back.
So what do you think of having all this automated? How good would it be to have this kind of nurturing of new inquiries happen while you're asleep? Well, it might sound quite complex. This isn't all that hard to set up using email marketing software. There's a lot of software out there that is built to do exactly this kind of automated system. In fact, if you've been an email subscriber to my blog or podcast for any length of time, you've probably experienced my own nurture sequence where I give you some links to favorite posts and ask you to write back, and I might ask you questions and things like that. It's just a brilliant way to get to know people without having to perhaps be on the phone all day or answering voicemail messages and that kind of thing. Email is the way that many, many people are communicating these days. Parents are certainly familiar with it for school and all of that kind of stuff. So if you'd like help setting up this kind of thing for yourself, then we can definitely help you in the inner circle. And in fact, I'm actually moving now to explore the potential of Facebook Messenger as a way to connect with other teachers. And that could be something that you could do as well, because we all know that our parents, our students' parents, are on Facebook. It's a great way to find new students' parents. It's also a great way to nurture and contact them. So that could be another step down the track for you if you're finding this interesting.
Hi Tim, congratulations, 100 podcasts, that's brilliant. And they've all been great. Hard to choose my favourite, but I think it has to be Piano Safari. Catherine and Julie were so enthusiastic speaking about their method, and a lot of the things made so much sense to me that I rushed out, bought it, and I'm converted. I love it. I've taught 3 beginners with it now, and I think the most important little thing from it, well, it's not a little thing, is it? It's an important thing, not to play legato too soon. And I didn't realize that. And I just think it's helped me so much with my teaching, and it's helped my pupils too. So I've learned lots from lots of the podcasts, and I'm always really enthusiastic to go out and try the new thing, you know, and get the program notes, and yeah, I love it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rachel. That was Rachel Wherry from the UK for that lovely voicemail. It's great to hear how much impact the Piano Safari episode in particular has had on your teaching. And I know that many others enjoyed that episode in particular. In fact, it leads on really nicely to our last section for today on teaching transformations, because the first clip that I've chosen is actually a segment from that very podcast episode. One issue that all piano teachers face at some stage is students whose last knuckle joints tend to collapse. I call it buckled knuckles, and it's a really common issue for students. It's when their last joint tends to flex the wrong direction, and it's kind of what would happen if you, you know, just pushed your finger onto a button on the wall or something like that. Rather than saying strong, that last joint tends to flex the wrong way. But how do you fix it? In episode 71, I had the pleasure of talking to Julie and Katie, the authors of Piano Safari, which is a self-published method. And here's what they had to say about this issue and a whole lot of other issues facing beginner students. One of the things I really love, of course, is how they use animal associations to capture the imagination of beginners. Have a listen to their approach in this clip.
One of the things I really love about the method is this connection you make between animals and technical maneuvers at the piano, because it really, really works with kids. They kind of get it and they can remember things. So I'm interested to know how you came up with it. And maybe you could give us a couple of examples for teachers that aren't familiar with how you approach this.
Sure. So that's the part that came most directly out of my dissertation research, because of the teachers that I interviewed with their various technical backgrounds. I boiled that all down to the commonalities among all the teachers, and then there were a certain set of motions, or what you call technical maneuvers. I like that word, maneuvers, that pretty much all the teachers used with their beginners. So that we turned into the seven animal techniques because, for instance, one of the first technique exercise is an arm drop just to help the student find their arm weight. But it's much more fun to call it the lion paw than the arm drop.
Yeah.
And then once we started calling it the lion paw, then we're like, well, we should get a stuffed animal that has a floppy arm. And so then we use the stuffed animals with the really little kids to explain this lion has a floppy arm. Is your arm floppy? Can you flop it on the piano and wake the lion up? And I make the lion like really scared when they do a good drop on the piano and they just laugh and laugh. I mean, it works with all ages. You just have to use the animal with the kids that it's going to work best with. Mm. And then another interesting exercise was the Zechariah Zebra one, which sounds like has that rhythm. And that was a mystery to me because in my original research study with four teachers before I did the extra seven or whatever later, three out of the four teachers used that exercise. And I had never thought of doing something like that before. Mary Craig Powell, Carolyn Schock, and Marvin Blickenstaff. And they all had different names for it. Mississippi Hop Frog, Colorado Mountain, Ebenezer Sneezer. But it's all the same rhythm.
Yeah.
And they played it on one note. And so I asked Mary Craig Powell, I'm like, why do you do this weird violin Suzuki thing? You know? And she said that the reason is it helps them develop a loose arm to play repeated notes fast. You have to have a loose arm to be able to do that. And then the other reason is it's much easier to develop firm fingernail joints, those end joints that tend to collapse, if you're playing repeated notes rather than consecutive fingers. So playing on one finger really helps firm up those joints. So that was just a revelation to me. I had no idea. And then we work on it one finger at a time so that they know how to play each finger individually. So the thumb is up on its corner playing. Finger two and three are the easiest fingers. Finger four needs to stand a little bit taller so that the elbow doesn't pull it back. And then finger five plays on its outside corner. And gradually the kids will develop their hand shape on each finger like that.
After chatting with Katie and Julie, testing out their method with students and hearing how engaging it is from other teachers as well, Piano Safari is actually now my favorite method and the one that I recommend to teachers, particularly after they've explored my Notebook Beginner framework. It leads on really, really well and in fact can be used in conjunction with my own creative approach there. One of the most important things that I've picked up from exploring Piano Safari and discussing it with other teachers is the issue of non-legato touch for beginners. I'll let Julie explain.
And one of the biggest breakthroughs I found, which maybe should have been common knowledge, but I didn't know, is that it's much easier for children to develop a good hand shape if they play non-legato first until they're firmly in control of their forearm before they try to play legato and connect the fingers. And then once they do start playing legato, they should still have the arm involved on every note to stay aligned behind the arm and to produce a good tone, because we have a modern piano with heavy action, so very small children aren't going to be able to produce a good tone with only their fingers. And also, if you play with just your fingers, then it's likely you'll get stiff in your arm unless you have super awesome control, which kids don't have yet. So non-legato first, then legato, and then gradually refining the arm motions for longer and longer phrases.
I think this is a huge reason why so many transfer students have what I call flying fingers, which is where they can't help but lift other fingers as they play. So you'll kind of see it, they'll play with their second finger and their pinky and fourth finger will lift up in the air. And if they play with their pinky, it'll lie down and the rest of their hand will lift up. And so you get this kind of flying fingers approach. And it's just because students haven't spent the time gaining proper control that this non-legato approach affords. So if you're interested in finding out more about this method, and I can tell you right now that it is incredibly thoroughly researched and tested, head to pianosafari.com. Let's move now onto another aspect of effective beginner teaching, and that's rote. Amy Greer, who co-authored a book of rote teaching pieces with Dennis Alexander, who I also interviewed in episode 64 discussing why creativity matters. Amy, join me on the podcast to explain why rote teaching should be an important part of any teacher's beginner method. Regardless of what books you do, what creative activities you do, whatever you do, I think rote teaching can have a huge impact. And here's Amy talking about why.
So rote teaching is teaching. It's not so different than what kids have been doing for each other for years when they teach each other chopsticks and they teach each other heart and soul and teach each other the theme to Ode to Joy or whatever. That's rote teaching. It's like one pattern, one note, one phrase, one part at a time until they build this piece. And what can happen is that they can do this without knowing any of the names of the notes on the piano or any of their flats and sharps. If a piece is very, very patterned, then it can be taught by rote easily and can teach students all sorts of really helpful musical things. Ear training, pattern recognition, just the physical choreography of moving up and down the piano. A good rote piece keeps you out of the center of the piano. I once had a pedagogy teacher who encouraged us to make sure we taught all 88 keys and not just the 20 in the middle.
Absolutely.
And rote teaching really it opens up the doors for things like that from the very beginning. I almost always teach a rote piece in an interview lesson. It's a way for me to see how quickly a kid will learn. and it's a way for the kid to walk out the door with something.
I love rote teaching for students as it allows them to play music which is well above their reading level. And that can have a huge impact on motivation because it means that your students will have some fantastic material to sort of show off in front of their friends or when they're at their house or in front of their school at assembly or in front of their class, whatever it is. Something that doesn't sound babyish or simple sounds a lot harder than it is. And they might have only been playing it for a couple of weeks. One of my students loved a piece in Piano Safari called I Love Coffee, and he played it for his school assembly, and people totally loved it. He got such a buzz, he couldn't wait to learn more music, and that kind of motivation just rolled on. And that's what it's all about. Rote teaching, if you haven't kind of picked it up yet, is just an approach to letting kids, showing kids how to play things by actually demonstrating it and getting them to copy so that, again, they can learn music that's a bit harder than what they could otherwise read, but it gives them such great motivation. I feature a beginner rote piece in my Notebook Beginners Framework, which was written by Paula Dreyer. And you can access her music online by searching for her books. They're called Little Gems for Piano. And I highly recommend both those books and also Amy and Dennis's book too. You can find out more about that in episode 79, which was called Rote Teaching with Amy Greer. One of the most challenging aspects of teaching piano is supporting students with special needs and adjusting your teaching to suit different students' learning styles. This was the focus on the blog and podcast for a whole month in 2016, and we'll link to all the articles about this topic in the show notes, which are again at timtopham.com/episode100. One of the interviews from that month featured a wonderful, humble teacher by the name of Susan Bassett, who has created free online training videos to help teachers of special needs students at her website, pianoforspecialneeds.com. Here's my favorite clip from her episode, which was number 57.
It's not about you. It's not about you looking good at the recital. It is not about whether or not this student can keep up with your program. It's not about that. My motto in my studio is success is measured in smiles. All I want at the end of the day is for that student to walk out of my studio singing and dancing and happy. Because these students have so little opportunity. Of course, the ones that are in school, the schools in America do provide, they're required to provide a lot of assistance. But some of my students are adults now. They're young adults now. They have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to go. And I was planning to retire at the beginning of the summer, and one of the mothers came to me and said, oh, please don't, because my son has nowhere else to go. He has nothing else to do. And some of these students are just so isolated because they don't talk. They don't fit into society. There's nothing for them to do but sit around the house and do what?
Mm.
And so you can't, it's not about you. It's not about your program. It's not about, have they learned what I want them to learn so that they will have achieved this by the end of the class? That's not the purpose of these lessons. The purpose of these lessons is to make the student feel good and to impart and to give self-esteem. And that is your only goal. Now, I do it through music. And if I had, now, I've got this one student I've been trying to teach him for 4 years at Middle C. He's the guy in the middle with a line through his head. Okay, now, I have to say that intellectually, 4 years on Middle C can be a bit much. But, you know, he loves his lessons. He yeah. loves his lessons. He has nowhere else to go. And he goes home, they set the keyboard up and they start playing and praise God, I have done what I need to do. I have given this young man something that he enjoys doing that without me, he wouldn't have it.
If that clip doesn't remind you of all the important work that we're doing each day in our studios, I don't know what will. And while this discussion was specifically about special needs students, her statement, you know, it's not about you, goes for all of us. And it's why I encourage everyone to think about what the goals are for their students whenever planning teaching. Moving on to our last clip now in this special Best of 100th episode features TED speaker Anita Collins, who came on my show back in episode 32 to talk about neuroscience and what the research says about music lesson motivation. If you've ever been frustrated by teenage students in particular, who seem to be going really, really well at first and may have been learning with you for a number of years and then suddenly quit when they get to about age 13 or 14, then you'll love this discussion. And I've chosen a special section just for you about that particular age group. Listen out also for the trombone joke at the end. See if you can get it.
My frustration was, why would they up and quit an instrument they were playing for the past 4 years they seemingly loved? They were involved in all the groups, and then suddenly it was like, no, I'm giving up, or I'm going to play guitar instead of playing trumpet. It's like, what's happening here? Do I have any influence on this, or can I do something? So what's helped me with the neuroscience is understanding that the brain has cycles and growth cycles, and they're now sort of starting to pin them down. The first one is between 0 and 7, and the brain's just growing and growing. We talk about kids as a sponge. And then at the 7 years of age, they do something without us knowing, the brain does. It does something called pruning, which is exactly what it sounds like. The brain takes to all of its different areas with a huge scythe and goes, I don't need that, haven't used that, that's not useful, I've integrated that already, so it's not good. And they do it again at around 14. So it got me thinking about what have I experienced on the outside of these students at 14. So they've been learning, I'm a clarinet teacher, they've been doing that with me for 4 years, and then they just seem to, there's lack of focus, they don't practice, their timetable goes all out of whack, they could arrive in any mood under the sun. and this research got me thinking about my practice with kids of that age, because I used to just think you just need to hold on that little bit longer, get them through to about 15, and they seem to come out of it. But it's actually neurologically, there's a hell of a lot of stuff going on, and that is influenced very seriously by puberty as well. So they're not concentrating on what I'm talking about at all, because there's so much going on inside their bodies. It helped me to go, okay, how would I adjust my teaching? How would I change my approach to practice? What are their motivations at that age, considering so much is actually going on? And they do come out of it. And the thing is, by the time you see that wonderful kid in year 12, a French horn player who's ducked, they've done all the pruning, they've got some extra space in their brain, but also they've hit that intrinsic motivational stage when they go, I actually really love this for me. This makes me feel good. I feel successful. I can see the direct pattern between if I practice here, I get this result and I feel good, so I'll practice some more so I'll feel good. And that happens by the end of year 12. But we have these, it's not a straight line. It's a flow all the way through that we, I think, as music teachers need to be able to respond to, but also know more about what might be going on for those students.
Can you remember back to what you changed about your teaching, if anything, for those 14-year-olds that were all over the place and pruning in their brains going on to try and keep them engaged?
Yes. I tested out a lot of things, but sort of by accident, I was finding more out about this research and I would share it with my students. So I'd explicitly say, do you know what's going on in your head right now? I would come up with these little things like, you know, there's a little Grim Reaper and he's scything away in there. And I think that was hilarious. I thought that was fun. And I'd say, that's what's going on. And that's why it's really hard for you to focus as long as you have been able to. And then I'd talk about, because again, with boys, they would grow and they'd be able to play a note. And then the next week they couldn't because their fingers had got that much longer. So important. I'd say I'd talk to them explicitly about, this is what's happening inside your body. This is how it's playing out on the outside. And that's why you're not feeling you're getting so far ahead. And I didn't mean to do it, but I found that giving them the information, explaining it to them, but also getting them to reflect on how they were feeling, gave them a language for the frustration they were feeling. And I also said, it's going to stop. If this too will pass. You know, you're going to get 15, you're going to get 16. This is not going to happen anymore. And it's sort of like through knowledge, through information, they became far more, they were the master of their musical development, not what's happening to me, I feel awful, therefore I will quit.
Yeah, I can't play. It's all useless. Why won't
I? Now, I could play these notes last week. I can't get them to set. The funniest ones I find are trombone players. Seventh position used to be there and now it's theirs.
Were you aware of adolescent brain pruning? Totally revolutionary. I had no idea until I discussed this with Anita, and it was fascinating doing more of my own research online about this. And I think this will be relevant if you have children of your own too, not just your students. Understanding why teens quit through a neuroscience lens and how to start conversations about it with students and their parents could be the difference between a student quitting and actually staying with you. And it's why I titled this episode, the original episode was titled, What to Say to Parents When Their Child is About to Quit, with Anita Collins. So that's back in episode number 32. Would you have this kind of conversation with your teenage students or children? Let me know what you think. And by the way, did you get that trombone gag at the end? If you haven't played trombone or seen it, you might not have understood. She was talking about seventh position and the fact that, of course, trombonists play their notes by extending a slide out from their body. And that's how you get that kind of sound, right? And so each note is in a different position as they extend their arm. So when students hit adolescence and suddenly all their limbs start growing, they have to keep adjusting their tuning to suit the extending length of their arms. I thought it was great, great little analogy and a fun way to finish up. So that's it. I really hope you enjoyed this look back at the first 100 episodes. And thanks again to all the guests who have appeared on the podcast and people who've contributed in any way to the podcast. Of course, with 100 episodes of around an hour each, it was incredibly hard to narrow it down. And I would have loved to have included many more clips. Of course, there are many, many more great conversations out there. And I encourage you to set aside some time to go back through some of those ones and have a listen to them. Remember that they're all accessible on iTunes on your phone, and the best way by far to access podcasts is to listen to them while you're doing something else. So if you go on your phone and open the podcast app and search in there for Tim Topham, you'll be able to access any of these episodes and just scroll through them, find out one which sparks your interest and just have a listen. I do hope you'll take advantage of them. They're all there for you. And now that we've got to 100, we start a new segment in the life of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank my podcast production team, without whose help these could not be possible. So that includes Nicola, Sean, Leslie, Ruby, and Balaj. Thank you all so much for the work that you do supporting creative piano teaching all around the world. For more information and a full transcript of what we've discussed today and a link to all those articles and all the different people who we've featured today, head to timtopham.com/episode100. And a quick reminder too that, of course, you can now subscribe to me via Facebook Messenger. So if you're finding your inbox is just completely overflowing with great piano teaching ideas, but you can never get around to reading them, and you would just like me to ping you on Facebook when a new podcast comes out, then find out more about how to do that at timtopham.com/Facebook. It only takes one click. Next week on the podcast, we're going to be talking all about using modes for composition. And this is an article or a topic I've wanted to discuss for some time now, because people are always asking me about modes. And while some people just think about modes as being white notes on the piano and stuff like that, I think there's actually a much better way to think about it. So I'm going to create a fantastic download that you'll be able to use in your teaching, and I guarantee it'll be really, really valuable for you. So that's next week. Can't wait to share it with you. Stay tuned then, and thanks again for all your support over the last 100 episodes.
That will conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon PIANOPODCAST for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.